calling the meeting to order yet. We don't have quorum, but we're going to get started with our presenter today. And we'll call the meeting to order when we get enough members to make quorum. Today we've got a report from the Legislative Auditor's Office on the Conservation Improvement Program, known as SIP, which is our energy energy program that we require here in the state of Minnesota for all utility companies. The report basically audited and reviewed practices and the program overall on the level of efficiencies and benefits the state is getting out of it as per the claims that some are making, and try to objectively measure how well the program is or isn't working, and what kind of benefits we as a state and the utility companies get for every dollar they invest. And so with that, we'll call the Legislative Auditor's office up here, John Peters and Jim Noble.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor, and with me is John Patterson, who was the project manager for the evaluation. Also in the audience is Dan Jacobson, who assisted with this project. Mr. Chairman, I do want to thank you and the members for this opportunity to present our report. There was a time, and I think some of us in this room probably remember a time, when energy conservation was one of our nation's most urgent concerns. Some would say it still should be, but the reality is that energy conservation does not get a lot of public attention these days. In fact, some people may have forgotten that the state continues to mandate energy conservation efforts through the Energy Conservation Improvement Program, or as the chairman indicated, as it's called, SIP. It is, after all, not a normal government program. Money for the program is not appropriated by the legislature. The program is funded directly by energy company revenues. And although the program is overseen by the Minnesota Department of Commerce, energy companies have considerable discretion to decide how they will use the funds. The program, as I think the chairman alluded to, is not free of controversy or critics. Some have questioned whether the program is cost-effective and whether it is being efficiently administered by the Department of Commerce. In response to these concerns and questions, last spring the Legislative Audit Commission directed the Legislative Auditor's Office to evaluate the program. And as I indicated, Mr. Patterson managed the evaluation, and he's going to present our findings and recommendations. Before he does that, though, I do want to acknowledge that we received the complete cooperation from the Department of Commerce and Minnesota Utilities. In particular, I want to thank Commissioner Wilson and Deputy Commissioner Garvey. They both showed a great deal of interest in and support for this evaluation from beginning to end, and they have given us a very positive response to our recommendations. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if there are no questions of me, I'd like to... Mr. Chairman, I think there is a question.
Representative Anderson.
How about the fees? Are they sufficient to pay for the study, or is there more money than necessary coming in, or what's happening?
Mr. Nobles, and some of this might come out in the presentation of the report, or not?
Yes, I would say, Representative Anderson and Mr. Chairman, we're going to cover a lot of that in the presentation, how the money is spent and how effectively it's spent. So let's have Mr. Patterson make that presentation, and then Mr. Representative Anderson, if we don't answer that question, we'll come back to it.
Perfect. Thank you. Mr. Patterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Patterson with the Office of Legislative Auditor. I'm going to present our findings and recommendations concerning the Energy Conservation Improvement Program, which is more commonly referred to as SIP. Under SIP, utilities fund conservation activities that reduce the consumption of electricity and natural gas. These efforts are an important component of the state's strategy trying to meet its residents' energy needs and should be carried out cost-effectively. To evaluate the program, we address the following questions. First, is the program cost-effective? Second, is conservation in Minnesota experiencing diminishing returns because the most cost-effective conservation activities have already been carried out? or does the state have the potential for more cost-effective conservation going into the future? Third, do state laws, rules, and procedures facilitate or hinder the selection and execution of cost-effective conservation? And finally, how well does the Department of Commerce oversee the program? Before discussing our findings and recommendations about these issues, I'd like to first discuss some background information about how the program works. Under the program, the utilities must devote a portion of their gross operating revenues to conservation. Utilities with nuclear power plants, the electric utilities with nuclear power plants, must devote 2.0% of the revenue, while other electric utilities must devote 1.5%. On the natural gas side, the utilities devote 0.5% of their revenues. In 2003, in total, the state's utilities devoted about $91 million to conservation. Utilities use these funds to provide rebates and other financial incentives to their customers who purchase energy-efficient products. Residential customers receive rebates for such things as efficient furnaces, boilers, air conditioners, refrigerators, and light bulbs. Low-income households receive financial assistance to weatherize their homes and replace inefficient appliances. And commercial and industrial customers receive financial assistance for purchasing efficient lighting systems, motors, air compressors, and refrigeration systems, among other products. Utilities devote most of their SIP funding to products and measures that assist their commercial and industrial customers. Only about a third of the funding goes to residential customers, and even a smaller share goes to low-income households. This slide I have up now shows the amount of funding that each utility devoted to SIP in 2003. The first eight lines show the amount of funding provided by the eight investor-owned utilities, and the second to last line shows the amount of funding provided by the municipal and cooperative utilities in aggregate. Minnesota has well over 100 municipal utilities and about 46 distribution cooperatives. Important thing to note in this slide is that Xcel Energy dominates the electric market and provides most of the SIP funding. On the natural gas side, Xcel Energy provides a substantial share of the funding for natural gas projects because it dominates the natural gas market. Finally, as the last line shows, the SIP program for the electric programs is substantially larger than the natural gas programs, accounting for about $77 million of funding compared to about $14 million for natural gas projects. Before administering the conservation programs and offering rebates, utilities submit biennial SIP plans to the Department of Commerce for review. These plans lay out what the utilities plan to do with their funding for the next 2 years. The department reviews these plans to ensure that the utilities will meet the program requirements, offer cost-effective conservation activities, and accurately estimate their energy savings that come from conservation. Utilities also submit annual status reports at the end of each year that describe their activities and achievements from the previous year through the SIP program. And the department also reviews these reports to ensure the utilities are actually meeting their program requirements. SIP requirements vary between investor-owned and municipal and cooperative utilities. Investor-owned utilities have more requirements, and the Department of Commerce's oversight of these utilities is binding. The Commission of Commerce can order changes in the SIP activities of these utilities and their other conservation activities. Consequently, the Department has a lengthy review process for examining these the SIP activities of these utilities. In contrast, the Department's oversight of the SIP activities of the municipal and cooperative utilities is only advisory. Consequently, the Department's review of these utilities is less substantial. A conservation program or project is cost-effective if its benefits outweigh its costs. Under SIP, cost-effectiveness is measured using four different tests. Each test looks at the benefits and costs of the program from the perspective of different segments of society. The primary test is the societal test, which determines if conservation is cost-effective for society as a whole. The participant test determines if conservation is cost-effective for energy customers who participate in the SIP program by receiving rebates for buying energy-efficient products. These customers will have lower energy bills because of conservation, but they'll also have to spend a little bit more money to buy the more efficient energy-efficient products. The rate pair test measures the impact the conservation will have on the electricity and natural gas rates paid by the energy customers who do not participate in SIP. And finally, the utility test compares the costs that utilities will face by carrying out conservation activities against the costs that they would have carried out if they provided an equivalent amount of energy compared to with what was conserved. Of these tests, the department relies most heavily on the societal test because it helps them determine if the program is in the public's interest overall public's interest. The next couple of slides I'm going to talk about a little more detail about the calculations that go into the societal test, because it's the test that we relied on most heavily in our evaluation. From a societal perspective, there are three primary components or benefits of conservation. First, electric utilities do not have to buy as much fuel to run their power plants, and will have lower operation and maintenance costs at these plants. And the gas utilities won't have to provide as much natural gas to their customers. In addition, utilities will have less need to build additional energy infrastructure. For example, the electric utilities can avoid or at least delay the construction of new power plants, transmission lines, and distribution systems. On the natural gas side, the utilities will have less need to put in pipelines. Another benefit of conservation is reduced environmental damage. The burning of fossil fuels emits pollutants that contribute to environmental degradation and other adverse human health effects. Under the societal test, conservation has two primary costs. First, utilities must spend money to run and operate the program. And second, energy-efficient products that energy customers buy are typically more expensive than the standard products that the customers would have bought without the program. The price difference between the two products is considered the cost of conservation. A project is cost-effective if its benefits are greater than its costs, and this is often expressed as a benefit-cost ratio. Looking specifically at the societal test, you get a ratio by first adding together the energy, capacity, and environmental benefit of the program, divide this by the program cost and the participant cost. The sum of a ratio that is greater than one indicates that the benefits of the program outweigh its costs. We don't have time to really get bogged down in the details of how the benefit cost calculations are computed for each of the tests. I just want to point out that the methodology is somewhat similar for the other tests as it is for the societal test. Based on the benefit cost ratios reported by Minnesota's investor-owned utilities, SIP's electric programs in 2003 were cost effective. As the slide shows, the societal ratio in 2003 was 2.9, which was substantially higher than the 1.0 threshold, which indicates if a program is cost effective or not. The ratios for the other three tests were also at or above one. The natural gas projects were also cost effective. And I'd like to point out before going on that these ratios we're reporting now, and we'll get in a little more detail as the presentation proceeds, apply to the numbers reported by the investor-owned utilities. The Department of Commerce does not require the municipal and cooperative utilities to report similar figures. To assess the accuracy of the 2003 benefit cost ratios, we examined underlying assumptions and methodologies that the utilities used. On balance, we found the utilities' estimates understated the cost effectiveness of the program because of some problems in their estimates. These problems included the use of out-of-date assumptions, inconsistent methods and assumptions between the different utilities, and the use of an inappropriate benefit cost model for evaluating the natural gas projects. Next few slides, I'll briefly describe some of these examples of these problems, but want to point out in Chapter 2 of the full report, we have a more lengthy discussion of all the problems we found in the benefit cost calculations. For natural gas conservation projects, the price of natural gas is a key input into the benefit cost calculations. It determines the economic value of the energy that is conserved. The higher the price of natural gas, the more beneficial conservation will be. To compute the benefits of the 2003 conservation activities, the natural gas utilities used the price of natural gas in 2002 rather than 2003. However, the price climbed significantly by 2003. For example, the commodity price of gas, the price the utilities pay to buy the gas from the wholesalers, rose from about $2.50 per 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas to over $5 per 1,000 cubic feet. If utilities used the current price of gas when they computed the 2003 benefit cost ratios, the societal test would have been about 48% higher. The utilities use out-of-date assumptions because the Department of Commerce did not allow them to adjust their assumptions for the 2 years that a SIP plan is in effect. For example, utilities prepared the 2003-2004 SIP plans in 2002. Consequently, the department requires them to keep using these 2002 assumptions when they report their final 2003 and 2004 benefit cost ratios. In 2003, the utilities' estimates of avoided environmental damage that comes with conservation range from $0 to $5.50 per megawatt hour of electricity conserved. Inconsistent assumptions between the utilities caused some of this variation. One utility did not even include environmental benefits in their benefit cost calculations. Two utilities used a method that was developed by the Public Utilities Commission for estimating environmental damage, or in this case, the avoidance of environmental damage. The department expects but does not require the utility to use the PUC's method. And finally, the last investor-owned utility or the last electric investor-owned utility use a method used by Iowa utilities to estimate the avoided environmental benefits, to avoid environmental damage. Many states and utilities around the country use a model that was developed in California for determining the benefits and costs of conservation. This model is widely recognized as the industry standard. In fact, the model that Minnesota's electric utilities use is based on this model. However, the natural gas model is inconsistent with it. The details of this inconsistency get quite technical, but I just want to point out the bottom line is that the benefit-cost ratio, the survival ratio, that Minnesota utilities would have computed if they'd used a model based on a national one, the ratios would have been 10 to 50% higher than they currently reported. To address this problem, the Department of Commerce has already proposed changes to the natural gas model used by Minnesota utilities to make it more consistent with the national model. I've already shown that SIP was cost-effective in 2003, and in fact, the utility's benefit-cost ratios were probably too low. But we also looked at the cost-effectiveness of the program over time. This graph shows that in recent years, cost-effectiveness has not declined substantially for the electric program. While there have been some ups and downs, it has remained relatively constant or stable, especially in the last few years. The benefit-cost ratios for the natural gas projects have also remained relatively stable, indicating at least in the last few years that SIP is not experiencing diminishing returns. In fact, Minnesota has the potential for additional cost-effective conservation going into the future. According to research carried out by a consulting firm that we hired, SIP has the potential to reduce the electricity needs of Minnesotans by 10 to 20% in 5 to 10 years from now through cost-effective conservation. In addition, it has the potential to reduce the natural gas needs of our residents by 15 to 30%. But I do want to point out that these are cost-effective strategies. They may not actually be achievable. An example would be many people consider complex fluorescent lights to be cost-effective, but some people choose not to install them because they don't like the quality of light. So even though there's the potential for this economic cost-effective conservation, some of it may not be achievable. But the consultant also found that Minnesota's estimates of the potential for cost-effective conservation were consistent with estimates that were carried out elsewhere in the country as a point of comparison. Finding and carrying out cost-effective conservation is a primary focus of the SIP program. However, some state laws, rules, and procedures do reduce the cost-effectiveness of the program. For example, state law requires utilities to devote a portion of their SIP funding to go to projects that assist low-income households. However, these low-income projects are generally less cost-effective than other conservation projects. In addition, the Department of Commerce has a policy that the utilities should use their SIP funds to serve a broad range of customers, including residential, commercial, and industrial. However, the residential programs and projects are less cost-effective than the commercial and industrial projects. If Minnesota wanted to maximize the cost-effectiveness of the program, it would want to the utilities would want to devote the vast majority of the SIP funding to the commercial industrial projects. However, the requirements that SIP serve low-income households and residential customers ensures that these customers who also pay in the SIP program have access to the program funds and the benefits that come from the conservation. Yet utilities, low-income advocates, environmental groups, and the Department of Commerce all have concerns about how the low-income program is currently being administered. As I've mentioned before, this program funds such things as home weatherization and the replacement of inefficient appliances. The utilities report that these low-income projects are generally not cost-effective. In addition, stakeholders have concerns about the accuracy of the estimates the utilities have prepared for the low-income projects. Some of the concerns suggest the ratios are too high, the benefit-cost ratios are too high, while others suggest they are too low. While we do not have time to get into the details of these issues, we do recommend that the Department of Commerce create a task force of department staff, utility officials, and other stakeholders to look at these concerns and then report back to the 2006 legislature with their findings and recommendations. I'm now going to discuss how well the Department of Commerce oversees SIP activities. The following slides will apply to the department's oversight of the utilities, of the investor-owned utilities. Later on, I'll give a brief description of the oversight of the municipal and cooperative utilities.
John, can I just interrupt you quick? I'm going to officially call this meeting to order. We have quorum, and while we're at it, why don't we just quick approve the minutes? Representative Sharon moves the approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you. Sorry, John, you can proceed.
No problem, Mr. Chairman. The investor-owned utilities provide a lot of documentation to the Department of Commerce in their SIP plans. These plans include project descriptions, program data, benefit cost calculations, and information on the engineering and economic assumptions they use in their analysis. The plans typically typically run from being about 100 pages long to well over 500 pages. On top of all this documentation, the department usually requires the utilities to respond to additional information requests during the review process. We found that the department's review of all this documentation is generally thorough in order to determine that the utilities are complying with program requirements and that they are carrying out cost-effective conservation. However, we found that the department's review process has some deficiencies. As I've already mentioned in earlier slides, there are problems with the accuracy of the benefit cost calculations that the utilities prepare, and the department has not caught or corrected these problems in time. In addition, the department's review of the electric utilities engineering assumptions is less thorough than the review of the natural gas assumptions. In terms of expenditures, conservation sponsored by the electric utilities are four times greater than the conservation programs sponsored by the natural gas utilities. Yet the department spends 20% less time reviewing the engineering assumptions of the electric utilities than they do the engineering assumptions of the natural gas utilities. Furthermore, the department does not assess the marketing strategies of the utilities. Marketing is a critical part of any conservation program to ensure that customers understand they get rebates for buying energy-efficient products and that they understand the benefits of conservation in general. The legislature and the department need to address these issues. As a first step, the legislature should give the Department of Commerce the authority to switch SIP from a two-year to a four-year program. This would allow the utilities to file and the department to review SIP plans every four years rather than every 2 years. With fewer plans being filed each year, the department should have additional time to review each plan more thoroughly. The department should use this additional time to address the oversight problems that we have identified in our report. And most importantly, the department should correct the problems in the benefit cost calculation that we have identified. While switching from a two-year to a four-year program should give the department more time and resources to look at the plans more thoroughly, it may not work as intended. Thus, the department should first test the longer filing cycle with one or two investor-owned utilities to see how well it works. If it works well, they can then have the other utilities switch to a four-year filing cycle. If it doesn't work well, they should go back, require all the utilities to have a two-year filing cycle. Finally, even if a four-year cycle works well, the department should always give the utilities the option of filing every 2 years if they choose to do so. I'd also like to discuss the Department of Commerce's organizational structure that is used to oversee the SIP program. The department's review process has two steps. In the first step, the department's analysts review the SIP plans and other SIP activities and make recommendations to the Commissioner of Commerce. In the second step, the department's policy staff, working directly with the commissioner or deputy commissioner, make the department's final decisions. While the department is reviewing utility SIP activities, the analysts and the policy staff can't communicate with each other except through formal information requests, which become public documents. They cannot go into each other's offices to discuss the SIP activities being reviewed. The structure is part of a quasi-judicial process in which the department tries to restrict communication between the commissioner and other parties involved in the process, including its own analysts. The purpose of the restriction is to keep the policy staff, or the department's decision makers, an arm's length distance from the other parties involved. We found the structure to be inefficient. It requires the department to go through two different discovery processes. First, the department's analysts devote one or two full-time employee equivalents to understand the SIP plans and activities of the utilities. Then the department's policy staff come in and add another full-time equivalent to do essentially the same thing. The structure also creates confusion. Within the department, the analysts have the best understanding of the utility SIP activities and conservation in general. These analysts assess SIP activities to ensure the department, ensure the utilities are meeting their program requirements and that they are using the SIP program to benefit society as a whole. The analysts also prepare lengthy justifications for their recommendations. However, the policy staff do not always adopt the recommendations that the analysts come up with, and some stakeholders have raised questions about the rationale and the reasons for their decisions. The department should eliminate the communication restriction within the department. Without the restriction, the department will only have to go through one discovery process, which should save time and resources. In addition, this change would give the commissioner direct access to his or her analysts and the expertise they have when making the department's final decision. Greater communication will ensure the department's decisions are well informed. And finally, rather than seeing the analysts as another advocacy group trying to persuade the commission to take a certain position, the department should view and use the analyst as a department resource to ensure that the department is making well-informed and balanced decisions. Finally, I'd like to briefly discuss the department's oversight of the municipal and cooperative utilities. While SIP requirements for the municipal and cooperative utilities are less substantial than the requirements on the investor-owned utilities, some municipal and cooperative utilities have to compile a substantial amount of information to be filed with the department. However, the department only carries out a limited review of this information. For example, the department asks the cooperatives and larger municipal utilities to compute the energy savings that their conservation activities generate. However, we found these estimates to be suspect, and the department really doesn't use these figures for any specific purpose. Collecting information for the sake of collecting it is not productive, and the department should either stop collecting all this information or actually use it. We recommend the department give the SIP information that the municipal and cooperative utilities provide the department more attention. In conclusion, I'd like to summarize our key findings. First, SIP is cost-effective. Second, Minnesota has more opportunities for cost-effective conservation going into the future. And third, SIP can be improved. Mr. Chairman, that concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that overview and your work on that report. Members, any questions? Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Patterson, just one question here. As far as on, I certainly don't expect you to have a crystal ball here, you know, as far as forecasting how this is going to work in the future or anything, but one of the things here I noticed here as far as for future potential future energy savings here, you've got that from 10 to 20% for Minnesota's electricity needs, and I was wondering, can you tell us, is that in the commercial realm, or is that in the residential realm, or utility realm? Where do you see that happening? Because there's a lot of talk that everybody's, you know, taking so much advantage of the SIP dollars that are out there today. Where do you see this coming from?
Mr. Patterson.
Representative, I described where those numbers came from. Maybe that will give you a better idea of what the potential is in different segments. Three utilities, Xcel, Otter Tail Power, Interstate Power and Light, prepared energy potential savings studies. And we gave these studies to a consultant we hired to evaluate those studies and compare them to studies elsewhere in the country. And based on those studies, he derived that was energy savings potential. And I want to emphasize that's the cost-effective savings potential. There may be market reasons why that you wouldn't actually achieve that. Interstate Power and Light and Xcel, I think, was sort of across the board among all segments. Otter Tail Powers was more focused on commercial industrial. And the problem is I can't get too much in detail of the specifics of it because the utilities have classified those documents as trade secret. So I'd be hesitant to go beyond saying anything beyond that.
Thank you.
Going back to Representative Anderson's question earlier, I guess I'm not sure if it completely got covered. Representative Anderson, do you want to ask that again, or do you feel you got enough information?
I got enough information.
Okay. Mr. Patterson, Mr. Garvey wants to speak after this. I'll just ask the question, and it's maybe more appropriate for them, but some of these changes, your office doesn't put together any sort of bills that do the department. That would, or the PUC or us as legislators, that would have to bring forth these recommended changes, correct?
Sure.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chairman, if I might just add, this is Mr. Noble speaking.
Mr. Noble.
We'd be happy to work with you or other members if you would like us to sit down and be a little more specific about legislative action that might be needed as a result of some of our recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. And to one of you, getting back to the societal test, in discussing some of this yesterday with you, that, as I understand it, the department primarily uses the societal test to measure the cost benefit, but we've heard numbers of $7 back for every dollar invested. Can you clarify that again, why that number gets floated around, and why that benefit sounds so much greater than the 2-to-3-to-1 benefit that you've concluded is the more accurate way to measure this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The 7-to-1 ratio the department reported back in 2003 was based on the utility test. That is, looking at the utility's cost of conservation versus the cost they would have had to carry out to produce a certain amount of energy. And that was the best number they had at that time. We now have now computed the utility test ratio is more like 5-to-1 using more up-to-date information. And the utility test ratio is usually, almost always, higher than the societal test ratio due to the fact that some of the costs that go into the societal test are excluded from the utility test. An example would be the program participants' cost of buying energy-efficient products is in the societal test, but not in the utility test. And for reasons of the different components going into the test, it's generally, the societal test is generally lower.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, can you say a little bit more about the issue of cost effectiveness relative to the low-income folks, the fact that there's other issues relative to just the money end that might be figured in terms of how people view cost effectiveness? Can you say a little bit more about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's various concerns about the cost effectiveness of the low-income program. Some advocates will argue that the societal test doesn't capture all society's benefits of conservation. A couple examples would be when you have low-income people and assist low-income people in reducing energy bills, they're more likely to pay their bills. Therefore, the utility would have lower collection costs, disconnection costs, payment arrears, and those types of benefits don't go into the societal test calculation, along with just the benefits of society of having people having more stable housing. So some advocates have advocated for putting those types of components in benefit cost ratios, which would increase the benefits. But on the flip side, the way that the program works right now for low-income weatherization is it piggybacks off of the Department of Energy's, the U.S. Department of Energy's weatherization program. And so a lot of homes are being jointly funded with SIP dollars and federal dollars to weatherize the same home. And it becomes very difficult to separate out the how much of a program's of the energy savings to be attributed to each program. And there's concerns that utilities are reporting all of the energy savings that come from pooling both together the DOE and the SIP funds, but only in the for the benefit side, but only reporting the costs of the SIP program, which inflates the benefit cost ratio. And we don't have time to see how extensive that was, but there's evidence that it's occurring in some of the utilities. And that's one of the issues. I think the department needs to sit down with the stakeholders and figure out what the true benefit cost ratio is for this program. And we didn't have time to give recommendations, but at least the issue needs to be addressed.
So, Mr. Patterson, on that society issue, and then Representative Hilty, I'll get you a question. Some would argue that that's not in there, but isn't the purpose of the program conservation of energy? And if a company has less disconnect or less bills and arrears, that really isn't conserving or producing more energy. And so couldn't you argue that that shouldn't be in the test as far as a societal test of conserving energy?
Mr. Chairman, you could make that argument, and I think it's somewhat of a value judgment of what you want the test to measure. If you want to focus purely on energy components of the program, I think that's a valid criticism or critique of it. But in the same time, we are including the environmental benefits of conservation in the test, and you could maybe possibly make the same argument about the environmental benefits that is less directly related to, you know, energy production costs than and environmental benefits. But again, it's I have the value judgment of what when you design these tests, the designers what they want to include, and I think we're not in a position to say what should and should not be included in the past.
But in your analysis, the low-income weatherization portion of the SIP program, one has some vague rules as far as, is it really how much of the SIP dollars is really gaining that benefit, or is it actually more invested to get that benefit that they're measuring? And two, it sounded like one of your conclusions would be if we want the SIP dollars to be used for the most bang for the buck purpose, we probably should look at more industrial conversions to capture more conservation benefits than residential properties can gain us as far as lowering the demand and the need for the power. We can gain more of that by the more industrial changes than residential. Is that kind of accurate of how you guys came up with your final analysis?
Mr. Chairman, just I think that's accurate, but I put a caveat onto it. And the caveat is that the commercial industrial projects are generally the most cost-effective ones. If you want to maximize the program, that's where the most of the money should go. But there's a whole distributional equity question involved. You have the residential customers, the low-end customers, paying into the program, and how much do you want to ensure that they also have access to the program and its benefits? And that's really an equity question, a policy question that you as a legislature need to grapple with. But as evaluators looking at more just objective information, we can come down to either side of that.
But if the program's purpose is to conserve energy, it seems like the mission should try to find the most effective ways to slow that energy use. But that's I agree, that's a policy equity question. Representative Vilti.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, between your questions and Representative Johnson's, my original question has pretty much been answered, but your line of questioning does suggest something else to me, which is maybe what this comes down to, since no matter who the beneficiaries other than the power industry itself and conservation are from this program, it amounts to a subsidy. So the question I think you were sort of pursuing is, does it make more sense to subsidize industry or low-income householders? My experience in operating a small manufacturing business for a number of years has been that generally, if we're managing our business sensibly at all, we try to explore all of those possibilities, and it's obviously to our advantage, for instance, to convert to lighting systems that use less energy, improve our heating systems, and generally, if you have a well-run business, it will manage to do that on its own. So maybe we should consider, in addition to the bang for the buck, what this program can make happen or not, being that I think with the low income aspect, were it not for the program, that probably wouldn't happen, whereas in many industrial applications, it's going to happen whether you have the program or not.
I assume that's just a comment, Representative Hilty. The only response I would have to that, Representative Hilty, is if it's going to happen, whether this program is in existence or not, with the industrial, why aren't they all taken care of?
Mr. Chairman,
up to this point.
Yes. As a comment, I have something in a report that may be of interest to that very question.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hole in the whole energy conservation field. I don't want to get too technical here, but there's a concept called free riders, and that's people who go and buy an energy efficient product, receive the rebate when they would have done it anyways on their own. So the energy conservation they occurred could be attributed to the program, but probably shouldn't be because it didn't occur because of the program. And in Chapter 2, we have a whole discussion of this free rider effect. And the utilities are trying to estimate and take out of their energy savings estimates the people who are taking care of advantage of the program when they would have done their own anyways. And our consultant found that generally utilities are making reasonable assumptions on with regard to those people. So the benefit cost ratios we are reporting already try to take that into account.
Sure. Thank you. Any other questions? Good work. Good work by your office. We sure appreciate your digging into this program that has probably had some varying controversy at times and questions of benefits, and some improvements can always be made to make the program operate better, get better bang for our dollars, and we'll look forward to trying to implement some of those over the months of this session. So with that, let's call our Deputy Commissioner Garvey up for just some comments as well on this report, and then we'll probably be adjourning early. So, Mr. Garvey, you're standing between us and adjournment.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Meeting adjourned. Mr. Garvey, please proceed. We'd be interested in just some of your observations or comments on this program. And up front, do you envision the department embracing some of these as a department bill or something we should move as a committee? I'd be interested in your comments on that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications. It is an honor once again to appear before you this afternoon. It is also an honor to be able to come before you in response to this report prepared by the Office of Legislative Auditor. We at the department think that it was a very thorough, comprehensive, thoughtful report that we are very, very pleased to have had done. We sought it being done as part of the 2003 Prairie Island legislation. We were very pleased that the Legislative Auditor, the Legislative Audit Commission accepted it and asked the auditor to proceed with it. We are very, very impressed with how the auditor went about doing the study. It is a very, very complicated issue with a great deal of money being involved. We think that this report that they have produced provides a great deal of useful information, constructive criticism that we take to heart. First and foremost, we find it gratifying and affirming that our belief that the SIP program, the dollars that ratepayers spend on energy conservation through their utilities, is cost effective. We also take it with comfort that we, as the agency that oversees or reviews those programs, are doing a thorough and adequate job in that. We also take the comments and suggestions and additional perspectives on how we can do that job better very, very seriously. In the back of the report, starting on approximately page 67, is the department's letter from me to Auditor Noble that outlines our official response to the report. But in sum, let me just sort of walk through some of the key findings and recommendations. We agree that allowing the utilities to file their biennial SIP reports to perhaps a four-year option at the commissioner's discretion is probably a good thing. It would give us more opportunity to delve into them more thoroughly, as the legislative auditor suggested we might want to do. That is one of the issues that would require a legislative change, Mr. Chairman, and I think we will be coming forward with a change that the language that would make that so. The second key recommendation of the report is that some of the methodologies of the department's review become more standardized. We think that that is a very good and constructive suggestion. We are already undertaking steps to do that. Some of those steps will take some thought and consideration, both on our part as well as working with industry and other stakeholders, but we do believe that the moving towards standardization is a good goal. Complete standardization, absolute standardization may not be obtainable, it may not be appropriate in all circumstances, but certainly the move towards greater standardization than where we are today is a very helpful recommendation and one that we are pursuing. In the department, we do have what's been referred to as a Chinese wall, where there is a series of analysts on one side that analyze the annual filings. They conclude their analysis and then send it proverbially over the wall to policy staff. The policy staff then report and make recommendations to me and the commissioner. We think that this wall has been has led to inefficiencies and some awkward processing. I think correctly the auditor has identified those, and we are in the process of removing that barrier right now. We do not need legislative approval for that, and that is, once again, an internal organizational effort that we are undertaking. The low-income program and its implementation and project. The legislative auditor has suggested that there be some changes made to that. Some of them need to be thought through, and hence they think that a report should be developed after we develop a work with the stakeholders on that. We are in the process of starting to work to develop that. In addition, there is a legislative issue dealing with the requirement that utilities spend no less than what they've done in the three-year historic rolling average. In theory, this was a useful idea, but in practice, it has turned into a barrier. We think that that needs to be legislatively changed, and we'll probably be bringing legislative language forward to you for your consideration and review and hopeful passage. The final comment that the legislative auditor suggested is the handling of the SIP and municipal, the municipal and co-op SIP filings. Currently, because of the way we provide merely advisory review to those entities, we do not give them the breadth of our experience and capabilities in that review and the expertise. I think the legislative auditor has correctly suggested that some of those expertise should be made more available to those entities, and we are going to be working out how to best advise them and give them the expertise that we at the department have in doing that. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation. Other than I want to thank you for hearing me this afternoon. I want to thank the legislative auditor for their thorough, considerate, and very positive report of our program.
Thank you, Mr. Garvey. Any questions, members? Otherwise, I would suggest, Mr. Garvey, I'll ask Bob Uloff if he can get with you to start drafting that language, and perhaps the members of the committee, if you have the things that you want to see or not see relative to this report or the SIP program, let's keep it in mind. I would hope in a couple of weeks we could have that bill in front of us, and I might even have a thing or two myself, Mr. Garvey. So Mr. Uloff can get with you shortly here, and then take the report and put it into a draft form for our committee. So with that, thank you, Mr. Garvey.
Thank you.
And members, we just have one housekeeping item quick to do. I need to move to refer five house files down to the gambling division, or the gaming division. And with that, the representative, I'll move that the following house files, Brian will announce them for the record.
401, 463, 485, 514, and 519.
Those house files are moved to refer to the gaming division. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. With that, members, just a thumbnail sketch of the schedule tomorrow. Tomorrow we've got a presentation by the CAPEX 2020 consortium relating to transmission needs in the state. So that'll be tomorrow's agenda item. Next week we have a couple of bills coming. We'll try to bring that small wind incentive bill back next Wednesday. And Tuesday we've got some liquor. I thought I heard a lion in the jungle, but anyways, Tuesday we've got some liquor bills, one that was vetoed last year, and then another one relating to Representative Hausman's constituent, and so that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of the next week and a half. So with that, members, meeting adjourned.